It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 11 lives were lost at the Tree of Life Synagogue 2 years ago today. The violent attack on the mourning worshipers brought the threat of domestic terrorism and extremism into stark view for the city of Pittsburgh. Signs reading "Stronger Than Hate" popped up in yards. Conversations happened outside of places of worship, and despite others' desires to divide, some say the community only came closer together. Rabbi Jeffrey Myers is the spiritual leader of the Tree of Life congregation. Rabbi, you wrote in a Time article last year, quote, "How does a rabbi respond? How does one inspire and guide others? There is no playbook to refer to, no rabbinic colleague to share their personal experience, no prior reflections upon which to ruminate," end quote. You've had another year. Have you come to any clearer understanding about what your role is?
Well, I've come to learn, Kevin, that, well, initially, I don't know why I really came to Pittsburgh, because I'm an East Coaster, and I didn't even know where Pittsburgh was, that clearly God wanted me to be in Pittsburgh in some way to shepherd the congregation and perhaps the community at large through this horror, to be able to try the best I can to heal, try the best that I can to promote an atmosphere of hope and inspiration so that we can find a path for brighter days ahead.
Rabbi, as leader of your congregation, people have been looking to you for guidance, answers, a great responsibility, maybe at times even a burden. So 2 years later, how are you doing?
I have good moments and I have bad moments. I'd like to think that if you look at the graph of me over the past 2 years, that it's been moving upward little by little. But I think that if you put it more under a microscope, you would see more like the oscilloscope. There are good moments of a day, and then there are bad moments of a day. And I've come to recognize that that's what trauma and grief is about, that you learn to live with the good moments. You learn to live with the bad moments. You integrate it into your being. But in the end, you hope that as you look at the overall picture, that the scale is moving upwards little by little.
Give me an example of one of those good moments.
The wedding of my daughter. It was this August 2nd. So despite COVID and despite the threat of bad weather, not only did I have the privilege of walking her up the driveway of our house in New Jersey, but then I had the privilege as the rabbi to perform the ceremony for my daughter, which is a rare privilege that any clergy can get. Elation is not even a strong enough positive word. I'm still on cloud nine in some regard because of that, and just grateful for God that I'm alive and that I could do it.
Has the community grown or changed over the last couple of years, Rabbi?
The caring and concern wasn't temporary, that it's continued unabated. Pittsburgh is not a perfect community by any stretch of the imagination, but I have observed that the goodness and the kindness that was extended to the Tree of Life community has continued unabated. People still care. People still sincerely ask, how are we doing? How can we help? And to me, I think it speaks volumes of the greater Pittsburgh community and the good, decent people that are here.
Does that kindness overcome that single horrific act of hate?
Nothing can overcome that. But in the scale, the goodness and kindness of people, A, help in the healing, B, remind us that there are far more good, decent people in the world than there are evil people like this perpetrator.
Of course, other congregations, Dor Hadash and New Light, shared the synagogue with you. How do you support one another?
I'll give you an example. on the commemorative date on the Jewish calendar, which is based upon the lunar calendar, so it's a different date. It falls this year, November 4th and 5th. So on November 5th, we're having a joint morning worship service, all three congregations in one, so that we will gather together, sharing in our sorrow, but yet praying together as one community.
Rabbi, you've held worship services at Rodef Shalom Synagogue since November of 2018, I believe. Are your members getting anxious about returning to their spiritual home?
Of course they are. I'm also mindful that for my congregation, they've been traumatized twice. Once by being forcibly evicted from their spiritual home by this active evil, and then a second time being forced to self-quarantine, COVID-19, effectively March 13th. So they've been doubly booted. Once again, not to use the old saw, but there is no playbook for me for a pandemic. I don't know anyone who was alive then. I know someone who was born the year after, who's a congregant of ours, who's told me stories of the 1918 pandemic. But again, what to do with that one? This is an example of where technology can be our friend, where we utilize it to the best that we can to reach out to people who so desperately seek human contact.
Right. A commemoration ceremony presented by the 1027 Healing Partnership will be held virtually this evening because of health concerns. Give us an idea. Has the pandemic slowed the healing process because maybe it's hindered people from coming together? Rabbi?
It's open wounds once again, particularly by being displaced once again. I can say that what I've learned over the time prior to the pandemic has helped given me some guidance in terms of how to respond to the trauma of my congregants, knowing the things that I do know, alas, gave me some preparation in ways to deal with the pandemic that I would have not had 1027 never occurred.
Rabbi, you mentioned that day of elation and maybe even more, your daughter's wedding. Give me an idea of something else you've been able to celebrate, to be joyful about over the last 24 months.
I can't give you one thing because there are a lot. I've learned to look for them as opposed to waiting for joy to knock on your door. It doesn't always work that way. It's like if I sat home and waited for Publishers Clearing House to knock on my door, if they're not going to knock on my door, am I going to be depressed every day? You want to go out and you want to find the joy, the beauty of being alive. So for me, just to sit on my front porch and look at the changing leaves, it's God's palette at work throughout nature. To me, that's magnificent. Those are just joyous and beautiful. And I just appreciate even just the simple things like that. So I think that really can be a model for a lot of people. There's a lot of good out there. Sometimes we just have lost track of how to find it. And we kind of need to get reacquainted with finding joy in our lives.
And finally, what are you most proud of personally and professionally?
I was thinking the same thing because I wrote a blog about a week or so ago, just speaking about how proud I was of my congregation between the professional staff and so many lay people who stepped forward for us to pull off Zoom High Holiday services live. A number of congregations did pre-recorded services. We ran the whole thing live from my living room. Once again, never did it before. We pulled it off. And I was just so proud of the fact that we're able to do that and hopefully bring a meaningful set of holy days to the congregation.
Rabbi Jeffrey Myers is the spiritual leader of the Tree of Life congregation. Thanks so much for joining us and our continued condolences and support.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As a child, Judah Samet survived the Nazi concentration camp Bergen-Belsen in Germany. More than seven decades later, Judah survived the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue here in Pittsburgh. We are in Mr. Samet's home, socially distanced. Judah, thanks so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Judah, did you ever expect that you would experience a similar hatred that you did as a child so many decades later in your place of worship, your place of solace?
I did not expect it. I came to the synagogue 4 minutes late because my housekeeper detained me. And I told her, I gotta go, I'm late already. And when I arrived there, and I was parking my car in the handicap lane, which was right next to the building, a guy came over, and he, very quietly, he showed me to roll down the window. And he said to me, better go back. There is a shooting in your synagogue. It took me probably about 2-3 seconds to process what he said, and sure enough, I saw a shooting going on between what was a detective that was behind the building. He was about 3 feet away from me, and another guy, about 2.5 cars away from me. So I was almost in the line of fire, and till today I marvel that he didn't even scratch my car.
So you, as a child,
yeah,
survived the concentration camp.
Right.
You survived what is known as a death train. Do you look back and say, how did I survive this shooting at Tree of Life? I assume the gunman could have shot you?
Very easily. I think the only reason he didn't shoot me is because he had to shoot the detective. The detective could kill him. I couldn't kill him.
So, as you've told us, you were a witness to shootings at Tree of Life 2 years ago.
Yeah.
The trial of Robert Bowers has not yet been scheduled. Will you be testifying?
Yeah. Now, I don't understand why it didn't take place yet. I can't figure that out. I'm going to look at him again. I'm sure he changed a little bit. But I'll recognize him.
It's been 2 years.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine.
How do you sense other members of the congregation are doing, other members of the community?
They were affected differently. I think because of my previous situation.
Your life history.
Right, my history. I grew up in an orphanage for 5.5 years, where for the first 6 months, we fought all the time because every kid there came from another country. We didn't understand each other, so we were killing each other. I was so full with rage that I told them, anybody who fights me, kill me, because I'm going to kill you. That's how much rage I had. And today I'm the exact opposite. You know, those were tough days.
So, because of your survival of the concentration camps and years in an orphanage, do you think that helped you deal with what happened at Tree of Life?
Yeah. I hear from people telling me that I'm very strong. And I agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very, very strong. Now, what made me strong, my mother was. My mother was like that.
You say that helped you be strong.
Oh, yeah.
And to deal with the Tree of Life shooting.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that the community as a whole has been so resilient. Why? It's such a horrible thing happened.
Well, a lot of people were crying and so forth. You know, I wouldn't say that you could explain resilience in degrees, you know.
Everybody's different.
Yeah. What ex- what impressed me about Pittsburgh, that the whole city, Jews, non-Jews, even Muslims, they all felt a part of it. And that kind of, you know, surprised me. So as far as resilience in my case, I always said my mother had three qualities. First, she was a beautiful woman. Secondly, she was smart of the box. Thirdly, she was fearless. That's what I inherited from her. I'm fearless.
Judah Sumet is a survivor of the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp and the Tree of Life attack 2 years ago. Judah, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Over an 18-month period after the Tree of Life attack, Mark Oppenheimer made 32 trips to Pittsburgh and conducted about 250 interviews. He's the host of the podcast Unorthodox, and his book about Squirrel Hill and the Tree of Life shooting will be published in August 2021. Mark, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
So when did you come to Pittsburgh?
I was doing reporting about Pittsburgh for my podcast, Unorthodox, which covers Jewish affairs. And we got a special episode out, I believe, the Monday after the attack. So I was in communication with reporters we had on the ground in Pittsburgh who had driven right in. I mean, they were there by Saturday night, I think.
So from those initial reports of your colleagues and you're putting together for the podcast, when did it sort of evolve in your head that these reports would be more, that there was a larger story that you wanted to explore?
I had grown up with a mythology of Squirrel Hill. My father always talked about his idyllic childhood there, and I ended up learning that as a Jewish neighborhood of about 100 years standing, it may be the oldest continuously, substantively Jewish neighborhood in the country. So I knew that this was there was a thick irony in terror and Jewish misery descending on a place that had been such a safe home for Jews for so long, almost uniquely long in the American experience. And it was that idea of terror coming to this neighborhood in particular after so many school shootings and so many mass shootings in America. It was this neighborhood in particular that really spoke to me.
Your book is not solely about that day, the synagogue and the three congregations that worshiped there. It's about neighborhood. What do you mean by neighborhood? What does it all entail?
I'm very interested in how the actual geographical fact of how people live together and fit together influences their well-being, how it changes their lives. And there's a lot of interesting research about the ways in which being physically close to other people improves our lives. And I was curious to see if it also made people more resilient, if it gave them more capacity to withstand the worst things that can happen to people. So the question that I started coming to Pittsburgh with was, how does the fact of Squirrel Hill, with its close-knit neighborhood, close-knit both geographically but also emotionally and spiritually, affect people's recovery in the aftermath of a mass tragedy?
So what qualities did you discover in the residents in the neighborhood that maybe led to a durability, an irrepressible nature?
Right. Jewishly, Squirrel Hill is unusual because people don't segregate themselves along Jewish denominational lines as much as they do in many American neighborhoods where Jews live. That is to say, very religious Orthodox Jews, what some would call ultra-Orthodox Jews, conservative Jews, Reform, Reconstructionist, and secular or unaffiliated Jews live near each other and know each other very well. There aren't the same demarcations where they won't set foot in each other's synagogues that you find in some American neighborhoods. In fact, I would say in most Jewish neighborhoods. So the fact that this tragedy happened to three congregations, two of which are historically part of the conservative movement, one of which identifies as Reconstructionist, that didn't mean that people from the Orthodox or Reform or secular communities weren't going to help. Quite to the contrary, all of those people, as well as plenty of non-Jews as well, rushed in to help. The second thing I'll say is that the mere fact of having so many of the key institutions close to each other, the supermarket, the post office, the library, the Jewish community center, means that people bump into each other. It means that you're less able to go a week or two without getting a hug from someone. And so that ends up being extremely important to resilience. It gets people out of their depressions a bit more. It's helpful for people who otherwise might end up being alone or being loners.
So your book, is it one of sadness, grief, hope?
I think it's largely a book of hope. People would say to me, that must be a very depressing project to work on. And I had to be honest with them and say, well, no, it's a sad project to work on, but it's not depressing. It's actually quite hopeful because you hear lots of stories of people doing for each other. You hear stories of people coming together and helping out and overcoming boundaries. And those are pretty hopeful stories. It's not a seamless fabric of optimism by any means. There are people who are still struggling daily, and that includes people who are very close geographically or relationally to those congregations. It also includes people who were not, who might have been out of town or didn't know anyone at those congregations, but are still just traumatized by the fact that they know that gun violence happened so close to home for them, and they're still scared in some ways.
Mark Oppenheimer is the host of the podcast Unorthodox, and his book about Squirrel Hill and the Tree of Life shooting will be published in August. Mark, thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's now been 2 years since a lone gunman walked in during Shabbat morning services with a semi-automatic rifle and 3 handguns. That morning, Pittsburgh lost Joyce Feinberg, Richard Gottfried, Rose Mallinger, Jerry Rabinowitz, Cecil Rosenthal, David Rosenthal, Bernice Simon, Sylvan Simon, Daniel Stein, Melvin Wax, and Irving Younger. Our thoughts are with their families. 6 Pittsburgh police officers were injured as they responded to the scene. Daniel Meade, Michael Smida, Tyler Paschal, John Person, Anthony Burke, and Tim Mattson. All but Officer Meade have returned to work. The horrific assault is the worst anti-Semitic attack in our nation's history. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of peaceful news.